Today I wanted to talk about, well, I actually, to be quite honest, I don't want to talk about anything. I say I wanted to talk about because these are things which just kind of felt their way to me up to the point when I have to sit here and speak. And it's interesting when I go through this process of trying to figure out what to say, it's very interesting because there are many, many things that I could say or many things which I might feel are important, yet I'm not even sure if they are. You know, it's like understanding how to express is easy. Having something significant to express is difficult. For example, if I was a teacher giving lessons in a particular syllabus, I would have an already existing body of knowledge to draw from, and I would present systematically that body of knowledge according to the level of the listener. When you have a already existing body of knowledge, you have something which is easy to talk about because there's already a recognized arrangement of topics, there's already a recognized series of details and sequences of events. You will find that there is a already existing methodology associated with the instruction of such a particular kind of knowledge. You will also find that in regards to spirituality, any religious kind of information that is given is usually in reference to some scripture which is very clear in what it says and how it says it. Nowadays, even if you were to consider the alternative system of spirituality or religion, you will find that there is similarly an already existing precedent and foundation for this kind of knowledge that you can refer to. They use particular kinds of a vocabulary, a particular understanding of the definition of terms, and thus it's rather easy to speak in a so-called modern alternative methodology. But when you speak from the point of view of your own realization, when you are sharing with others your daily or weekly experiences, you can enter into realms where there are no already existing templates that you can follow. It is quite possible, and in fact it's usually so, that your expression is much more difficult than when you are trying to explain something which has been explained before or which you have heard before. The reason I'm speaking about this is because I find that week after week, just to be personal about this, my expression to you is more or less a personal expression. I'm not reaching into some body of knowledge and repeating an already existing theme which I have understood and I'm regurgitating. Sometimes the topics or sometimes the themes which are spoken about are very personal. Sometimes they're not necessarily relevant to everyone. If somebody were to tell me, but you said this before, and try to pin me to that by saying this is what you believe, I might not be very impressed with that because I may not believe it today. It's a very interesting experience if you think about it. When you have a body of knowledge that you are fixed to, you are dedicated to, you believe in and wish to represent, things are easy. I mean, there have even been times when I felt very tired, very sick, very disturbed, and I would go out and give a lecture and just draw on already existing knowledge, repeat it. It wasn't difficult to speak and to seem to be very aware of what I was speaking about. But when you speak from the heart or when you speak from realization, you don't have that safety net. For example, you can have somebody whose an expert in their particular field of knowledge, even if it's a spiritual field of knowledge, and they may present things very perfectly and beautifully. And yet when it comes to a personal communication, a heart-to-heart, face-to-face sharing of the self, they may be lacking. Now, if you think about life, you think about practicality, if you think about the way our experiences unfold during the day, we do have our belief and we do have our necessity to deal with what's in front of us. There are things we know philosophically, we know from the point of view of knowledge, understanding, training to be right, and yet there are things we feel are right according to the particular moment we are in. Now, there are different ways to look at this. You could look at it from the point of view of a short-term result, long-term result. You could see the present moment as a short-term thing. You could see the following some superior so-called body of knowledge as a long-term thing. You could see it like that. Yet at the same time, we feel in the present that we wish to have experiences now. We wish to feel now. We wish to embrace the present moment rather than thinking about some future moment. So this brings about a conflict. We have this tension, the tugging between what we know to be right and the tugging between what we feel to be right now. And therefore, the statement that everybody does what they think is right at the time they do it is so important. Yet at the same time, other future moments come when in the present we feel badly about what we have done based on our knowledge, based on that body of understanding, which is furthering or is higher in the sense that something beyond our present feeling makes us want to act in another way. So when you're speaking in public, when you're giving, like, say, a lecture or a presentation or something like that, it is usually based upon an already existing body of knowledge or a research or something prepared that you just simply display in a very nice way. The challenge is basically how to present it, not what to present. Yet at the same time, when one is acting as the self, as the person, as the essence which feels and is the being that is expressing, one doesn't necessarily feel comfortable with expressing pre-digested notions. So what I'm doing here week after week is that I'm dealing with my experience. I'm dealing with trying to present it in the context of a concept, of a body of knowledge, which in some sense can be standardized. Yet at the same time, I'm trying to do it from the personal point of view of me who has been living this past week, who has come to some state where he has something to express as a person. This also brings about a conflict because, after all, why should you waste your time listening to me babble about my feelings from the previous week? And anyway, which body of knowledge am I presenting? This, I'm explaining this to you because I want you to understand the unique difficulties I face on Saturday morning when I wake up. What am I going to talk about? Now, it's not like I have a choice because I have to talk about something because I sit here, you come, and I really do have to say something because, after all, it would be just a waste of everyone's time if I didn't. Let's say we were all sitting around the breakfast table or a lunch together. Let's just imagine for a second we're all having a lunch together somewhere. Things would be very different because we're coming together, we're eating together. Even if you're not interested in what's being said, at least you can taste the food and we can joke together. Other people can speak. It is much easier that way because there's all of us interacting. And when we all interact, due to the fact that there are many of us involved, there's a lot of opportunity for diversity. But now when it's me sitting here and all of you sitting out there, there's no possibility of diversity. I actually have to come up with something to say which will be useful, relevant, valuable, and yet an expression of myself. Now, how to balance this? That is what I've been talking about today. Well, if you were to consider any communication, any expression you were to make, what you do when you express, what I do when I express, are very much the same. First of all, there has to be something that we wish to express. And that's not the same with everybody. There has to be a reason to do it. There has to be a motive. There has to be some impetus. Without that impetus, without that motivation, the expressions that we might make don't have any value. They don't have any power. Our energy is not behind them. I found in the last week, for the sake of others who were asking me questions about different projects they were doing, that I had to ask the question, well, what is the point of what you're doing? Why are you doing it? And what do you hope to accomplish? In other words, there has to be a clear format. There has to be a clear reason for anything to be expressed. Let's go back to that lunch we're all having together. When we are expressing ourselves there, there is a very clear reason why we do it. And that reason is that we are enjoying each other's company. We enjoy hearing each other. We enjoy relating with each other. There's nothing worse than having to be at a luncheon or a gathering like that because you have to be there and you have to listen and you have to smile and you have to pretend that you're having a good time. And there's nothing nicer than doing it because you love to do it. In fact, it brings a lot of joy out. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of joking. Now, in our expressions here, in our sharing here, there is, to a very large extent, a lot of spontaneity. I have not prepared these discussions. I have not even thought about them before I start speaking them. And because of that, they're filled with imperfection. In other words, there is probably, if I look back on it, if I think over something, I may say, I said that all wrong. I should have said it like this. It would be better like that. And that is a very difficult situation for somebody who demands perfection in his own speaking, like me. And I realized that this morning, and therefore I wanted to call this lecture today in perfection. Now, I have to confess, I'm a real verbal perfectionist. I have to express things exactly according to the way I feel they have to be expressed. In the majority of other things in my life, I'm not at all a perfectionist. But when it comes to speaking, when it comes to helping others solve their problems or to do some kind of therapeutic assistance, I'm very much a perfectionist. I want to say things in exactly the proper way to express exactly what it is that I have to express. And I want to do it in a way that you will understand it perfectly. Now, at the same time, I have to have something to express. I mean, after all, what's the use of expressing perfectly nothing of importance? So today, I'm in that dilemma. I am, here I am, attempting to perfectly express nothing of importance. So now it's an incredible problem. Here I am, striving for the perfection of expression and having absolutely nothing to express. And if you think about that, it's an extremely disturbing situation. So what is this perfection anyway? When I think about perfection, it leaves me blank. I've heard this word before. I've used this word often. I've worshipped the concept of perfection for many, many years. And in parts of my life, I have strived to manifest that perfection. And yet, Whenever I feel confident or satisfied that I have perfectly expressed something, I may look back upon it and I may say, no, that was not so. Something that I may have thought was perfect many, many years ago seems to be obsolete at the present moment. It may be perfect from all points of view except for the fact that it's meaningless. One can even spend many, many, many years perfectly doing something only later on to have it become meaningless later on from due to change of circumstances. And it's quite possible that those who we have labeled as perfect, those we have labeled as being in the epitome of perfection or being in the highest possible positions, are those who deeply feel very uncomfortable with this situation. Those who strive or who yearn the most to just have a luncheon with others and sit down and talk and laugh and joke. For example, people all over the world think of God as perfect. People all over the world worship God as that perfect being in all ways. And they project that feeling upon God. Everybody is speaking to God in that way, praying to God in that way, thinking about God in that way, feeling in that way. Let's take, for example, this is just a theoretical discussion. Let's say we have the innermost being of God, and then we have those expressions that God presents to others to deal with those who are interested in that perfect being. So we can have this core God, and then we have expansions of God. And those expansions may be the ones dealing with those seeking that perfection and that reciprocation with that perfection. And the core God is the one who sits and eats lunch with the friends and enjoys and laughs and make jokes and plays, who is yearning for the connection, who is yearning for real reciprocation. Now, it's quite difficult when we're dealing with perfection and imperfection. When imperfection meets perfection, there's some kind of problem there. For example, somebody who's so eager to perfectly present something, yet at the same time has nothing perfectly to present. And what is a perfect presentation of imperfection? So let's just for a second assume there is such a thing as perfection and imperfection and go back to God. We have a God here who, quite theoretically at least, would be very comfortable with having face-to-face relationships with others. If the perfect meets the imperfect, there's got to be some kind of lack of balance there. Even if you say that the perfect will be so perfect that the perfect will not allow the imperfect to see the perfection or understand the perfection of the perfect, I would say that's incomplete. Because the imperfect will always be aware that they are dealing with the perfect. This will make them uncomfortable. This will make them careful in their expressions. If you are a less than accomplished artist and you have to paint for the best artist in the world, or if you're the less than accomplished musician and you have to play music for the greatest musician in the world, you feel uncomfortable. You always feel uncomfortable because you're always aware of the fact that there's this perfect personality over there, or this super accomplished personality over there, who is observing what you are doing and naturally understanding the imperfection of what you're doing. And that makes you feel very uncomfortable because you can never fully relax in such a situation. And as we've seen in our meditations, unless you are fully relaxed, you can never manifest that beauty, that wonderful essence that you are, which is by definition perfect. So if you can't feel comfortable in relationship with God, you can never actually manifest fully what you are. There'll always be some kind of agitation, some kind of disturbance, some kind of tug on your consciousness. And if we, of course, understand God as being fully aware, we can understand how uncomfortable that would be to that core personality, because there's no real reciprocation due to that fear of the perfect. So perhaps God would say, damn your perfection, and hit you on the head with his flute. Therefore, for those who wish to actually relate with God in that, shall we say, extremely personal manner, the first thing that has to be given up is any fear. And just simply relax. To completely feel comfortable in that relationship without any consideration of the superiority of the other. That is actually the beauty of being a friend with God, or being a lover with God, or having some parental relationship with God, being the superior, so-called. It's free from any form of formality, any form of fear, any form of understanding the superiority, the perfection. Now, we're dealing here with something which we are not by nature generally equipped to do. It is very hard for almost all of us to enter into some relationship with anybody and be totally freed from fear, totally comfortable, totally relaxed, and totally ourselves. That's because we always feel there's something to lose when we do that, that we have something to lose. Basically, we have relationships with others, and inside there is this understanding that, well, if you really knew what I was like, you would not be so friendly towards me. Even here I sit in front of you, and I think the same way. If you actually knew what I was like, you would not be so friendly towards me. Because I'm just like you. Now, the funny thing is that this fear is true. Even though everybody feels like this, and even though we're all imperfect, when we find out the imperfections of others, we condemn them. Because we all think, somehow or another, well, we're the only ones who are so imperfect. Others should be perfect, like our parents, or our husbands or wives, or our leaders of state, and absolutely our spiritual leaders. Now, the interesting thing is that this fear which we have and which we do use when we see imperfection in others is the very thing which keeps us from actually having those deep relationships of meaning. So, we see it practically, how restricted we are in coming closer to others due to this conflict between imperfection and perfection. Think about it. How imperfection places such heavy demands upon perfection, and how perfection places no demands upon imperfection. Now, who is putting the demands upon us that makes us feel so uncomfortable with ourselves all the time for being imperfect? You could even say that this principle right there is one of the core elements of our expansion of consciousness. We are perfect within, yet we have such demands upon ourselves to be perfect. That is the imperfection. The perfect that demands perfection. The perfect that requires perfection. The perfect that is intolerant of imperfection is imperfect. I'm not going to say that one should embrace imperfection as perfection. I'm not going to say that. One may embrace imperfection, but not as perfection. The required action, the required mentality, is to allow imperfection, to tolerate it, to support it, so long as one is projecting a frustration of being imperfect. There's no question of coming to the original situation of the heart. So long as there's a demand, an expectation on the self, we'll not be able to manifest exactly that which we're expecting to. So this is the catch. Isn't that interesting? This incredible catch where the very thing that one condemns oneself for, that prevents one from being perfect, is the very thing that in fact does prevent one. The mentality of being frustrated with our imperfection. Now, I know that sounded a little bit insane. It even did when I was saying it. But in fact, it's such an important point. You see, everybody's striving for perfection. We all have these ideas that there is such a thing called perfection. And we're all insisting to have it. And in so many ways, we become frustrated when we don't find it. Therefore, you will find people selling perfection, selling illusions of perfection and making a lot of money on it. For example, you will find models in TV, models in magazines or whatever, who look so absolutely perfect in everything they are. They seem to be the epitome of beauty and form. Whereas in reality, there are multiple imperfect things about each of these people. You will find photographers have been airbrushing out their imperfections or avoiding to show the crooked nose in a certain way or the cellulite here and there. And so we are yearning for seeing the perfection in others, yet in reality, those who we worship as so perfect are just like us, just a little bit more advanced than whatever it is we want to pay for. We project that on others. We yearn for that, so then others come to present themselves to fulfill our needs, and we create a kind of a relationship based on, you're going to be the perfect, I'm the imperfect, and I'm going to observe you, I'm going to interact with you in that way. So we will also see that in spirituality. We will see that we have the same thing in spirituality. And when we find out those who we expect to be perfect are more or less like us, we become very disappointed. We become so disappointed in our heroes. We like to have heroes. We like to worship heroes. Yet at the same time, when we find out that the heroes are more or less like us, they've just done something heroic, we become frustrated. So I would think that what I'm really suggesting here is that we search for, we yearn for another model of perfection, another model of our spirituality. That we instead seek out inspiration rather than perfection. We seek out inspiration. We seek out that which can nourish us, that which can inspire us, that which can give us the impetus to move on. For when we start seeking that out, we start to find it in the most unlikely places. We start to see the expressions that people have made. We start to see them without demands, without expectations. We see the relationships. We see anything around us in terms of how it inspires us. Instead of thinking about how we will be inspired on a Saturday or a Sunday or whenever there's some religious function or some other kind of exposition, we find it in all things throughout our daily life. Let's again go back to God. that sounded pretty good, just as it was. I meant in the sense that do we have to only relate with God in a very specific way, or we can have just a constant flowing relationship with God? Do we have to hide? Do we have to be afraid of God? Or can we share our imperfections? Can we share our imperfect understandings, feelings, and so on with an open heart, with a friend? Now, it's easy to say, and it's harder to do because we feel embarrassed. And we don't really feel like throwing our dirt on such a pure entity. But if we were to understand that that entity is anyway all-pervading everywhere, and is already fully aware of that particular dirt that we're trying to hide, it only makes us feel stupid that we're trying to hide something from someone who already knows it. And if we open ourselves in that communication and that awareness and that relationship, and just be completely honest and without fear, it's the most healthy format of a communication that could possibly exist. In other words, I am like this, this is me. But not just the bad parts of me, also the good parts, all parts. This is me, I'm a package. You take me as I am. Yet at the same time, there's this like feeling that we have to work our way into trust. I want to give an example, which I'm sure some people are going to think is so insane, but I think it's so perfect. You know, when boys and girls or men and women first get together, there seems to be this like incredible rule that no one can know that you pass gas. You could be exploding inside, but you have to hold it in and find a way to escape somewhere and then let it out when no one's there. Especially girls. Girls, it's just a complete impossibility that the guys should ever know that they pass gas. Because the girls are very aware that they have to present themselves as this perfect being. Because they know deep inside that unless they do so, these guys aren't going to be interested in them. Because guys are basically beasts. And guys become so happy when they really love some girl. And when she finally passes her first gas in front of the guy. Because then he knows. She's comfortable with me. She accepts me. He can even go and tell all of his friends that, yeah, we're really in tight. She passed gas. Now just think about that. I mean, as funny as that may be, just think about that. How about hair on the legs? That's got to be shaved off, because if anybody were to see that I'm a hairy beast, then they're not going to be pleased with me. And we've got to be skinny. And we cannot stink. And breath has to smell good. Hair has to look good. Makeup has to be perfect. And just like when we're going to go out and meet somebody, every little part has to be perfect. Men or women, doesn't matter. Don't think the men don't care. They do the same thing, but in their own men way. So when we first are trying to develop trust between people, when we're first trying to develop a relationship, we go out of our way to show the perfection of what we are. And we're so conscious of this. We're so aware of this. We want to do everything just right, not to disturb the sensibilities of the other. But when we become more relaxed, we let that down and we feel very good in that imperfection. But after a while, that imperfection starts to grate on our nerves. And we start to say, why do you have to do that all the time? Why can't you stop that? What's wrong with you anyway? Don't you ever learn? And at the same time, we end up with the same problem. And yet it's so interesting. We first have to be perfect. Then we allow imperfection. And then we have to be perfect again. So just understand, we understand perfection, yet we want to come back to what we are, and yet there's always this demand to come back to perfection. We're not comfortable with imperfection. Even if imperfection is what we are, and we're comfortable with people accepting us as for what we are, still we require to move forward to perfection. So I would suggest this is our mission in this world. This is why we're here. This is what we do. This is our whole work. We were this illusion of perfection, but we had to be comfortable with our imperfection and just accept it. This part of us that was the illusory perfection brought us into this realm for some reason. And in this realm where we are comfortable in our imperfection, we are striving for the real perfection. And the real perfection is when you are fully comfortable with the perfection, without any demands, expectations, or illusions about what you are. And you can just relate with the Supreme, with God, just on a personal level, without worrying about all of these things. Because you won't say anything wrong out of fear, or you won't say anything wrong out of envy or jealousness. You won't have any feeling to cause pain. You won't even if you say things which are not exactly complimentary, it doesn't matter, because it's all in the mood of love. That relationship is built upon love, and there's no fear there, as there is in all of these imperfect dealings. You're better than me, and then for some reason or other, I have to fear that. I fear saying or doing or thinking something wrong. I fear your condemnation or your judgment, and a million other ways in which we fear. Our whole experience in this realm is to learn to be fearless, to love devoid of fear. For when we can love devoid of fear, we may then relate with, we may then enjoy together with the Supreme. So therefore, in the beginning, I said the main problem is this dichotomy between imperfection and perfection. And naturally, the imperfect has to approach perfection. But the real problem is the way the imperfect sees perfection and sees imperfection. Again, Krishna doesn't walk around thinking himself perfect all day. And if one of his friends were to disturb him with this conception, he would just bash him on the head with the flute. Hey, stop that. Let's play. Enough with all this philosophy and this understanding and this judging and this... Just have fun. Play. Enjoy. Love. So ultimately, you can see the core of the difficulty is in our fear of imperfection. And it's so amazingly beneficial when we simply accept our imperfection, and we don't judge it in ourselves or in others, and we just learn to love without any such demand or any concern with that imperfection. But it's almost impossible to do that because of our inherent requirement to move to perfection. And therefore, our sojourn, our journey through this realm is based upon that conflict between perfection and imperfection. And the more we are aware of that, the more we accept that, the more we just simply live with that and deal with it in all of our existence, the easier it will be for us. I have two questions here, which are related, which I think I can deal with. The first question is whether it is possible to substitute the conceptions of perfection and imperfection by words harmonious and not harmonious. Well, that's interesting in the sense that it seems that the person who asked this question has decided that harmony is a type of perfection. Now that brings up another way to look at perfection. For example, if I think it's perfect the way somebody imperfectly speaks, like a little child. In other words, the imperfect language of a little child gives me great pleasure. That great pleasure is very nice for me, so therefore I consider that just absolutely perfect. So in that case, we have a situation where something which ordinarily would be considered imperfect, I value as perfect. Now, let's say you needed a situation of conflict to arise for some political goal or for some economic goal. So you required to create this disharmony which would manifest as conflict. So when that disharmony arose, you would consider it perfect. Because you have defined perfection in that way. So for a person who defines perfection as harmony, that person would find harmony perfect. Now, one may feel quite harmonious within oneself, yet be in a situation which may not be according to one's conception of perfection. I won't bother getting into a whole bunch of examples and everything. It's not required. All that I'm really meaning to say here is that any particular quality you may consider as perfect would be your judgment of that quality as being perfect. But to be fair, when you would be totally absorbed in and integrated with your own spiritual energy and in relationship with others according to their spiritual energy, or even in relationships with the Supreme, you would feel very harmonious, no doubt about it. But there may be occasions when, for example, your relationship with Krishna may be disharmonious, in the sense there may be some conflict, there may be some situation which you don't feel very comfortable in. You would have to stretch various definitions to say that the gopis felt very harmonious when Krishna left for Mathura. Yet various people would consider that perfection in another sense. So again, it's how you define things according to the particular situation. Therefore, I would not want to substitute any words for the actual situation of perfection and imperfection. I would just leave perfection and imperfection as they are. I would not try to expand my understanding by adding or subtracting words. So here's another question here. Whereas we have spoken about the aspiration to perfection and the creation or acceptance of unhealthy forms of fear and a dissatisfaction when we do not come to that perfect platform. So could we, for instance, speak in terms of, he uses the word impeccability. I would probably use another word for that. Impeccable is a great word. But for the sake of everybody, I would use the word like doing things just right as being the way to deal with the imperfection. Well, absolutely, I would use that, because you try to do the right thing. You try to do the best thing you can do at the moment. You consider all the factors there are to consider, and you try to do the absolute best thing. Sure, this is definitely the best way to deal with imperfection and to deal with the continuous struggle to attain perfection. Absolutely, it's a great methodology, and I would applaud it in all ways. Okay, now I got another question here. Michael, in Newton's book, Destiny of Souls, it is spoken that the hell does not exist. We know many sources where it is written that hell does exist. So how does one deal with this account of hell not existing? Well, that's an interesting question in the context of this discussion, because hell is a place where the extremely imperfect would go. Now, from the point of view of a perfect personality, let's say you have a God here who's a perfect personality, and being totally aware, understands all of the problems and difficulties that people would go through in life, and has a conscious awareness of all of the imperfections of people, all of the struggles people are going through, even the whole sequences of events which led to their present mentality. And one would then have to ask, why would such a God create a hell? What would be the point of it? It would be very hard to answer that question. The only answer really is to punish us. But we already know that punishment doesn't usually change people very much. In fact, this was even stated by Maharaj Parikshit to Shukadeva Goswami. That's one of the problems, that you punish the criminal, he goes out and he does it again, because He's got the same mentality. Punishment doesn't change the mentality. In fact, often when you punish somebody, they become more bitter, more angry, more determined to get back. The idea of punishment, the idea of pain, the idea of hell, this fits very well within the human understanding. I did bad. I did wrong. I have sinned. I am imperfect. Therefore, I should suffer. And hell is the perfect place for me to suffer. It is the deterrent to keep me from sinning. It is the nuclear deterrent against sinners. A deterrent, that which keeps. Like, for example, I have nuclear bombs, you have nuclear bombs. We both don't throw them, because if I throw it on you, you throw it on me, and we both blow up. So if I sin and I know I'm going to go to hell, hell is such a horrible place, I will never sin. That's the idea. So this idea of hell is very similar to all human self-inflicted punishments for our imperfection. And therefore, from that point of view, the idea of hell is a quite unlikely thing to be created by God. But it can be created by man. It can be created by other non-godly beings, sure. It can be a place that one would place oneself because of feeling that one should be there. So the concept of hell is a troublesome one, because we are so expert at feeling ourselves deserving of such a hell. So basically we embrace the concept because it fits within our own self-condemnation. But I would not go so far as to say it does not exist, because if we are confident of its existence due to our need to self-condemn and to place ourselves there, we go there. We create it. It, because there's a need for it, it will exist. But I would not attribute hell to God. I would attribute hell to man. So that's another way to look at the same thing. I don't have any other questions.